Hello and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we discuss some topical leadership issues. This week, we're focusing on events up until the 11th of January 2019. My name's Nick Scott, and I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute of Leadership and Management, and I'm joined today by Kate Cooper, the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
Friday, the 4th of January, marked Fat Cat Friday, the day when the nation's highest paid CEOs have already earned the equivalent of the national average wage of just under £30,000. The Guardian reports that much of business success is due to the broader operating environment, reflecting state investment in infrastructure, education, law and order, and social security, topping up low wages. Does the Guardian have a point about the unacknowledged contribution to these business successes?
This is one of the problems of our current accounting systems, where we obviously focus on costs, we focus on attributable costs, we focus on costs that are within our control. And the costs that don't directly affect us, we don't account for. To what extent is the state supporting organisations in providing cost-effective or relatively cheap labour, certainly in comparison to what these chief execs are earning? Should schools, colleges, universities provide a training ground for people to be able to join organisations and then deliver wealth for shareholders? These are complicated questions, and I think a more comprehensive way of accounting for these different contributors to wealth that organisations report would be a great first step.
Julian Harris of City AM has argued that super talent deserves super rewards if these business leaders create billions in shareholder value. But he acknowledges that shareholders deserve sane, simple and transparent pay structures. Do you think there'd be greater acceptance if there was more transparency?
I think if a chief exec could present not only a ratio of how much more he or she earns compared to the lowest paid worker, which can range from, 10 times to hundreds of times, and also a rationale for why they earn that much. And then maybe there'd be a sense of acceptance and actually a sort of a pride in the fact that this chief exec is adding so much value to the business.
Well, our second item this week draws on a recently republished report from Ashridge, which adds some refinement to the traditional staff engagement model by dividing the disengaged into three subcategories. The disengaged themselves are inward-looking with a sense of dissatisfaction. A new group known as the content are disengaged from work and hence underperforming, but they're not unhappy with that, finding their personal rewards outside of work. And the third group are the pseudo-engaged, those who on the surface appear to be engaged, but really display dysfunctional behaviour. Do you think this fine-tuning of the disengaged characteristics helps leaders to develop strategies to better manage these disengaged teams?
I think it's really adding something interesting to the whole engagement debate, because, of course, you can't really be engaged, disengaged, rather like a yes, no, or an either or. So what Amy and her team are doing here at Ashridge is trying to help us to better understand what makes people really properly and fully engaged with their work and what doesn't. And it's knowing that there are differences. It's not as simple as will you go the extra mile or won't you? And when you think of how much we spend on engagement surveys and how keen we are to know about engagement scores, to better understand how we can reach those people who are not happy in their work, don't share the values of the organisation, whatever the reason for their disengagement, of course it helps all managers knowing which strategies to adopt that might work better than a more simplistic approach that engage, not engage might encourage one to take.
Senior researcher Dr. Amy Armstrong said around one in five teams display this pseudo-engagement behaviour, where individual self-promotion, upward management, and effectively playing the corporate game can lead to recognition such as promotion or better pay or bonuses. What can managers do to identify these individuals and teams and affect change within them?
Well, first of all, you have to recognise that you get the behaviours that you reward. And one of the mistakes immediately is calling a group of people who happen to be co-located, have some degree of codependency, a team. They're not a team. We use examples from sport quite frequently, and I think this is a really good way of saying what's a group of people and what's a team. A team all rely on each other in order to deliver an overall and a shared effect. If you're rewarding people individually, if you're praising people individually, if you're recognising people individually, then you will get the sort of behaviours that Amy and her team have discovered in this research.
Well, our third story this week again originates in The Guardian and asks whether workers should ever be paid more than their managers. The story cites a manager who discovered that one of her direct reports earns £20,000 per year more than she does. She reported the classic five stages of grief, with denial and anger being specifically mentioned, ultimately along with a severely damaged ego. So the first question here is, are there circumstances where it's legitimate for a worker to earn more than their manager?
There are situations where, yes, I think this is legitimate. I remember talking to a sales executive in the car industry who had actually had a managerial role, took the lower salary for the less stress, the shorter hours, and actually then decided to go back to the more highly paid role of salesperson, and knows that his manager in this case actually earns less than he does. And of course there are other situations where organisations have had historic pay scales, where there's an annual increment, where scales are changed and often changed downwards, that you might have somebody relatively young in a managerial position actually being paid less than somebody much older in a more junior position, and that's an accident of history.
Well, in this specific instance, the manager cited was particularly upset because she hadn't known. Is salary secrecy still justified today?
One of the things that emerged, I think, from the gender pay gap data published in April of 2018 was how important transparency is for making people understand the rate that goes with the job and not with the person. And I can understand this woman's dismay at finding out that somebody's earning so much more, because that seems to think that that person is being paid because of who they are, not because that's what the job warrants.
And finally this week, a recent opinion column in the Harvard Business Review challenged the world of business education on the dominance of business efficiency over other attributes. Business strategist Roger Martin cites specifics such as efficient cost management, efficient staffing in HR, efficient targeting in a marketing context, and argues that maximising these proxies for business effectiveness risks placing short-term and easily measurable values over ultimately more meaningful longer-term business objectives. Does Martin have a point? And if so, how could a change of culture be introduced?
If we're talking about business education, we're often talking about simulations. We bring things into the classroom that approximate or a representation of what's happening outside. Now, it's very difficult to do that in a meaningful and useful way if there's not a lot of data connected with it. And of course, efficiency really lends itself to data and to analysis and to number crunching. And of course, that is what people learn on MBA programmes. If you then translate that expectation of certainty and that everything can be analysed and put into a cost centre into the reality of working in organisations, of course you're going to not only be wrong, but very disappointed. And if you try and recreate situations where you're driven by cost, you're not building in adequate cushions for the unexpected.
Well, thanks very much for those insights, Kate. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week. please go to the website www.institutelm.com to find out more about the Institute of Leadership and Management.